or the theory might have. And there are the three-point couplings, Cijk, one for every triple of local operators. Of course, the fact that the local operators are organized in these representations will imply certain relations among these coefficients, reducing the genuinely important CFD data a bit down. The fact that this CFD data is sufficient to recover all these correlation functions is thanks due to the fact that a CFD has a convergent operator product expansion, which allows one to replace any product of two local operators by a sum of the local operators in the theory. The functional form of this summand is completely fixed by conformal symmetry up to a single numerical coefficient, which is, of course, again, this three-point coupling, which is therefore also sometimes called OP coefficient. Then we can take an n-point function, apply the OP to two of its local operators, get an n-1 point function, at least the sum of them, and we keep going until you find the sum of one-point functions, which are all zero in the CFD, except for those of the identity operator. Of course, this is very nice, but it's clear that not any CFD data will define a consistent conformal field theory. The consistency requirements on the CFD data are typically called the conformal bootstrap constraints, and they are basically the requirement that the operator product algebra, that is the algebra of local operators which has as its product the OPE, should be an associative algebra. Perhaps more familiar, it is the requirement that any four-point function should be crossing symmetric. And the question we can ask now is if these conformal bootstrap constraints are sufficiently powerful to actually solve this for the CFD, given some minimal input about the theory, like, of course, unitarity, but also some spectral assumptions. Unfortunately, the answer turns out to be no in almost all cases, except for certain two-dimensional CFTs. Basically, because the conformal bootstrap constraints are an infinite set of functional equations on an infinite amount of CFD data, and there's just no way to solve them. Of course, we shouldn't give up now. We should explore other options to extract as much information as possible from the conformal bootstrap constraints. And in the recent literature, one very promising route that has been taken is to put the problem on the computer and solve the constraints numerically in order to get bounds on various OP coefficients and dimensions of operators. Another option one can take is to consider certain limits, like, for example, the light cone limit, where you take two operators to approach each other on the light cone in the Minkowski picture. And also there, you can extract numerous important information about the CFT, and in fact, also its holographic dual. But I will consider the approach that maybe the conformal bootstrap equations allow for a truncation, which I can indeed solve analytically and exactly. And indeed, in recent years, it has become clear that extended superconformal field theories indeed allow for such exactly solvable truncations if there is a sufficient amount of supersymmetry. So for example, in four-dimensional theories with at least n equals 2 superconformal symmetry, you can find a truncation of the operator product algebra, which takes the form of a chiral algebra. Similarly, for six-dimensional theories with at least 2.0 supersymmetry, you can also carve out a chiral algebra. In this talk, however, I will focus on the three-dimensional theories which have at least n equals 4 superconformal supersymmetry, and I will show that one can define a certain truncation of the operator product algebra which takes the form of a one-dimensional topological algebra, by which I simply mean an associative but not necessarily commutative algebra, which also has an evaluation map which descends from taking vacuum expectation values in the three-dimensional CFD. And in fact, this topological algebra has also been discussed by this gentleman, but I will go a step further and I will actually show you that it can be identified with a quantization deformation problem of either the Higgs branch or the Coulomb branch of the theory, which will give us a lot of mileage in actually solving for the structure constants of this algebra. So in any of these truncations, the trick one employs is a cohomological one. One identifies a certain nilpotent supercharge and restricts oneself to the cohomology of that supercharge, and then studies the algebra of cohomology classes, and that algebra takes one of these simpler forms.
Can you give a cohomological construction from both the Higgs branch and the Coulomb branch?
Yes, it's separate. We will see when or how it appears. you can choose which one you do. Yep. So here's the outline of my talk. I will first briefly review some aspects of three-dimensional SCFTs and their Higgs branch geometry. Then I will introduce the nilpotent supercharge, which I will use to construct the cohomology, and show how the algebra of cohomology classes takes on the form that looks very much like a deformation quantization problem. Then I will indeed remind you of the mathematical definition of deformation quantization and some results on classifying them, to finally get to some interesting examples where we put all the machinery together, and I will conclude with some future directions. So let's get started with some simple stuff. A three-dimensional n equals 4 superconformal field theory has as its symmetry algebra OSP4/4R, which has as its bosonic subalgebra an SO4R symmetry, as well as an SP4R space-time symmetry, which is isomorphic to an SU2 plus SU2R symmetry plus the usual SO3,2 conformal algebra. You see, I put H and C labels for the two SU2 factors in the R symmetry because these act respectively on Higgs branch and Coulomb branch as isometries. The theory has 8 Poincaré supercharges, it has 8 conformal supercharges, and their anti-commutation relations are the usual ones. That detailed information is not very important, just Q with Q gives a P, S with S gives a K, and Q with S gives Lorentz dilatation and a combination of SU2R, SU2H and SU2C rotations. A bit more important for the remainder of the talk is that the Higgs branch of a three-dimensional n equals 4 SCFT is a hyperkähler cone. The fact that it's hyperkähler can be easily understood by taking a UV Lagrangian description of the theory and giving VEFs to the scalars in the hypermultiplets while making sure the D-term and F-term constraints are satisfied, and at the end also modding out by the gauge group. This construction is called hyperkähler quotient, and therefore we will end up with a hyperkähler manifold. I should also say that Higgs branch does not receive quantum correction, so this UV computation is still valid in the infrared SCFT fixed point. Now, just to remind you, the fact that it's hyperkähler means it has 3 complex structures, which by definition, of course, square to minus 1, and they satisfy a quaternion algebra, meaning that J1, J2 is J3 and cyclic versions thereof, and J2, J1 is minus J3 and cyclic. All 3 of them are compatible with the metric, meaning that for any 2 vector fields, x, y, we have equalities like this, and their associated Kähler forms are all closed. So that's just definition of a hyperkähler manifold. The Higgs branches are also cones, which is essentially a consequence of the fact that they must allow for an action of the dilatation operator. So they have a conical structure, and their metric looks like so, where R is some radial coordinate, and we have some base manifold. Now, the SU2HR symmetry I mentioned on the previous slide acts isometrically on this base, and while it acts on the base, it also rotates these 3 complex structures as a triplet of SU2. So that means that if I actually choose a particular Cartan generator inside SU2H, or perhaps more dramatically, if I choose an n equals 2 subalgebra of my n equals 4 algebra, then I immediately also have distinguished one of the 3 complex structures, namely the one that is annihilated by the action of this Cartan generator. Having chosen a complex structure, it's natural to start thinking of the hyperkähler manifold as just being a Kähler manifold with Kähler form omega 3 associated to this complex structure, and combining the other 2 Kähler forms into this complex object. Omega is omega 1 plus I omega 2, which is closed, of course, but it is also of type 2,0 with respect to this complex structure. So all this just to say that a hyperkähler manifold, when considered in a particular complex structure, has a holomorphic symplectic structure. It's naturally endowed with such a thing, which immediately implies that the ring of holomorphic functions over the Higgs branch, which is also called the holomorphic coordinate ring, comes with a natural holomorphic Poisson bracket, which is defined as over here. So that's really the conclusion of these last 2 slides. There is a natural holomorphic Poisson bracket, and it will re-emerge later on in the talk. Let's go back to some more physical notions, namely the Higgs branch Kähler ring operators. They're superconformal primary operators, meaning they're annihilated by all superconformal supercharges, as well as by half of the Poincaré supercharges, namely the ones I indicated over here. So they are the bottom component of certain half BPS multiplets, and they will. And the fact that they are called Higgs branch chiral ring operators is related to the fact that the operators would actually enter in these multiplets. If you would give them a VEF, you would be moving inside the Higgs branch. An alternative characterization of these Higgs branch chiral ring operators is by simply saying they're Lorentz scalar operators, which are singlets under SU2C, and which have conformal dimension equal to their SU2H Cartan charge, which has to take maximum value, which is equal to the spin of the representation of SU2H. So to tie this notion of Higgs branch chiral ring operators to the notion on the previous slide of the holomorphic coordinate ring, there is the simple statement that the two are identical. The Higgs branch chiral ring can be identified with the holomorphic coordinate ring of the Higgs branch. So let me conclude this introductory section by considering the simplest example of a n equals 4 SCFT, the free hypermultiplet. So its field content consists of four real scalars, which can be organized in a doublet of SU2H and a doublet of a flavor symmetry, which is this I index. And it also has a collection of fermions, which are doublet under SU2C, also carry flavor index, and of course a Lorentz index. The four real scalars can be organized as indicated in this matrix in the more natural language, Q and Q tilde and their complex conjugates. So SU2H would swap the rows, SU2 flavor would swap the columns, and the OPEs can be written covariantly as indicated over here, where of course I use the fact that a free scalar in three dimensions has dimension 1/2. Also, later on, it will be useful to remember that Wick's theorem allows one to compute any OPE of any composites of descendants in free theory. And finally, the Higgs branch of a free hypermultiplet is, of course, just C2. I can give independent real VEFs to all four real scalars. And given that I already gave meaning to the SU2H indices, I gave meaning to what the Cartan generator should be, I am already in some complex structure, and identification is given over here. W is Q tilde, Z is Q, Kähler form is the usual one for C2, and this 2,0 form is the holomorphic Poisson structure, which then gives rise to a holomorphic Poisson bracket on the Higgs branch chiral ring, which is just generated by Z and W. So this was the introductory material. Let's get to the more interesting part of the talk, namely, how do I truncate the conformal bootstrap equations to get an a tractable set of equations? The answer was cohomological, as I said in the beginning of the talk. And in order to select the nilpotent supercharge, which will do the job for me, I'm going to select a line inside my three-dimensional spacetime. Any line will do, and I will give it a coordinate S. The subalgebra of the conformal algebra, which keeps this line fixed setwise, is of course rotations in the plane orthogonal to the line, as well as conformal transformations along the line. And now the interesting statement one can make inside the superalgebra OSP4/4R is that this SU1,1 can be supersymmetrized in a variety of ways, but two of them will be interesting for my purposes, namely SU1,1/2, where I have additionally bosonic symmetries which are identical to the SU2HR symmetry, or SU1,1/2C. So at this point, I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to choose SU1,1/2H, but it's a totally arbitrary choice. I'm sitting in the infrared fixed point, and in the fixed point, there's no real difference between what I call Coulomb branch and Higgs branch. It's just an automorphism would swap the two. So I'm going to stick to Higgs branch language, but you can, in your mind, if you please, change everywhere to Coulomb branch language. So let's take this SU1,1/2 subalgebra and look a bit at its generators. It has conformal generators along the line, the SU2's generators, a central charge, and eight supercharges. Now, the important statement is that within this subalgebra, I can define two nilpotent supercharges, which I call Q1 and Q2. The precise form is not all that important, but what is sort of important is to remark that I inserted an arbitrary non-zero complex number, zeta, over here and over here. If I use an automorphism of the full algebra OSP4/4R, I can set this zeta to any value I like. I can put it to 1 if I please. Any value non-zero is good. So there's really no physical information in this parameter zeta. But for my purposes, it will serve a bookkeeping purpose. You can see what the bookkeeping purpose would be if you just look at this supercharge. If I insist that this supercharge has proper eigenvalue under the dilatation operator, you will see that zeta better has eigenvalue 1. And the same goes if I wanted to have proper eigenvalue under the Cartan generator of SU2H, it better has charge 1. There's no need for this Q to have proper eigenvalues. And if I don't insist on that, then the cohomology will not have proper eigenvalues under these generators. But from a three-dimensional point of view, it is a natural thing to require. And therefore, it may be later on natural to think of zeta having the bookkeeping purpose I just mentioned. Anyway, so I have these two superchargers, which are nilpotent. You can check that. And more importantly, they are also such that a certain diagonal combination of the SU1,1 conformal algebra of the line with the SU2H R symmetry is Q exact. I call this combination SL2 hat, and the generators are written over here. So their precise form is not all that important, except for the one for L hat minus 1. It consists of L minus 1, which is just a translation operator along the line, plus zeta times the SU2H lowering operator. So I have identified nilpotent superchargers. And the next step in my analysis should be to construct the cohomology of these superchargers. So let's do that. Let's start at the origin. I'm looking for operators which are Q closed, but which are not Q exact. And it's an easy exercise in computations of cohomologies to figure out that that means that the operator at the origin should be a Higgs branch chiral ring operator. So remember from a couple slides ago, Higgs branch chiral ring operators were scalar operators, singulate under SU2C, whose conformal dimension is equal to their SU2H Cartan eigenvalue, which moreover takes maximum values. So very good. At the origin, I know what's in the cohomology. Now I would like to move away from the origin. It's easy to see that the only way I can actually move away from the origin while staying inside the cohomology is by using a Q-closed operator. And then it's easy to see, if you go through the list of operators I have available, the only thing I can actually use is this L hat minus 1, which is not just Q closed, but in fact Q exact. So let's use this operator to translate my operators at the origin away from the origin as follows. Let's consider an operator which sits in the spin K over 2 representation of SU2H, and which is such that its SU2H highest weight state is in the Higgs branch chiral ring. Let's insert that at the origin and translate it with this L hat minus 1. It is an easy exercise to integrate the action of this translation generator and to find that I have not only translated the operator to the point S along the line, but while I have translated, I have also mixed in SU2H lowered components, just because over here, L hat minus 1 was not just translations, but also an SU2H lowering operation. So this mixing in is implemented by contracting all of the SU2H indices with this constant SU2H doublet, which I wrote over here. So now I have all the cohomology elements that I can, I've solved for the cohomology. But there is one thing one should have remarked by doing this translation operation, namely that I have used the Q exact operator, which means that in the cohomology, actually the position dependence will drop out. It was obtained in a Q exact fashion, and Q exact stuff drops out in cohomology. So in fact, the cohomology class of this twisted translated thing will not depend on the position. But there is another caveat, namely that if I have multiple operators inserted on the line, I should remember the order in which they are inserted, because there's no way I can actually move them around while staying inside cohomology. So I will keep the label for a little while longer. I will get rid of it soon enough. So this is the general structure of the cohomology. And let me make that all a bit more concrete by studying, again, the free hypermultiplet. So the Higgs branch chiral ring of the free hypermultiplets were all the SU2H highest weight state of the scalars, Q1J. And let me just look at the simplest one of them, just Q1J itself. The corresponding elemental homology was, when I inserted at the point S, obtained by not just translating, but while translating, also mixing in the SU2H lowered components, as indicated over here. And inside cohomology, the position dependence actually dropped out, but we keep it as a label to remind ourselves of the order of the operators. Now, the next question is, what is the algebra of such a cohomology class? And this I can easily read off by recalling the OPE and just inserting this kind of quantity at both, well, for both these Qs, and put them on a line. And I find, as a result, the following expression. Zeta epsilon ij times the sine of s. You have put one at 0. The other one has some coordinate along the line, which I call s. And there's also the Higgs branch chiral ring operator, q1j, q1i, q1j, inserted at the origin, plus q exact stuff. So let me now get rid of these labels. They are a bit cumbersome to drag around, and introduce a notation star, which just implements the product of two cohomology classes when they are inserted in order from left to right on the line, as defined over here. With this notation, this product turns into the following star product. And now things start becoming interesting. You can notice that this star product is not commutative, obviously, because there's an epsilon ij sitting here, which is antisymmetric. Another thing to notice is that the zeroth order term in zeta, namely this term, is just the usual product in the Higgs branch chiral ring. The first order term in zeta is, in fact, the holomorphic Poisson bracket I mentioned at the beginning. And more generally, inside the example of the free hypermultiplet, I can study the star product of any two Higgs branch chiral ring operators using Wick's theorem, and it takes the following form, where I have inserted an exponentiated differential operator with differentials that act to the left and to the right. Some of you may recognize this expression as a Moyal star product, which appears when quantizing the phase space of a free particle. So at this point, we can already start noticing that what we're really doing is quantizing some symplectic manifold. The more general structure you can figure out by just analyzing the OPE of the operators which enter inside in the cohomology of a generic three-dimensional N=4 subconformal field theory will take the following form. So let F and G just be two holomorphic functions which correspond to operators of conformal dimension P over 2 and Q over 2. Then I can argue that their star product necessarily takes this form. The zeroth order term in zeta is just the usual product. The first order term in zeta is this holomorphic Poisson bracket that any Higgs branch will come and end up with. And then there is a higher order tail in powers of zeta, where these CK are just some maps which take as input F and G and spit out another holomorphic function. There are a couple of properties of this star product that I should be aware of. Namely, most importantly, it is associative. This associativity immediately descends from the fact that the three-dimensional operator product algebra had to be associative. Those were the conformal bootstrap constraints, and they translate in the requirement that this star product is associative. Next, one should recall that I gave zeta a bookkeeping purpose of conformal dimension 1 and SU2H charge 1, and therefore it's clear that these maps CK, they cannot map F and G to any arbitrary element of the Higgs branch. No, it has to map it to an element which has grading such that if zeta has grading 1 under conformal dimension, the entire thing is still sensible. This property is called equivariance, and it's responsible for the fact that the upper limit of this sum does not go all the way to infinity, but it actually stops at the floor of P plus Q over 2. A next property is just simple observation that SU2 selection rules demand that if I take the OPE of a thing in a representation with spin P over 2 and a thing in representation spin Q over 2, I can only have things in representations P plus Q over 2, P plus Q over 2 minus 1, down to absolute value P minus Q over 2. This selection rule implies that there's a further truncation of this sum. Namely, it doesn't go all the way to p plus q over 2, but it only goes to the minimum of p and q. This property I would call the truncation property. And finally, it's easy to figure out that the symmetry properties of the operator product expansion demand that even powers of zeta are symmetric on the exchange of f and g, while odd powers are antisymmetric. There's one more property, which is almost the star of the rest of the talk, namely the unitarity. It is easy to figure out that unitarity demands that the two-point function of any complex scalar operator takes, well, first of all, conformal symmetry demands it takes this form, and unitarity demands that this norm that sits here is positive. It's a simple enough requirement, but this requirement translates in the star product of the previous slide into the requirement that if I introduce rho to be the rotation over pi degrees in SU2H, and I follow that by a complex conjugation, that then the form theta f of g, which is obtained by taking the constant term in the star product of rho of f of grading p and another thing of grading p, this thing should be a positive definite Hermitian form. So more simply, if I take some f and I take its rho of f, then the constant term in its star product should be positive. So there are these inequalities on certain constant terms in the star products, which will become important later on. So this was a general structure of the star product as I obtained it by just doing the truncation from the three-dimensional SCFT. Let me now rephrase this structure in terms of that of deformation quantization. It will become a little mathematical, but it will be worth the effort to go through this stuff anyway. So let me start with some commutative algebra, which has a Poisson structure and moreover carries some grading. Then I define a C-equivariant deformation quantization simply as a deformation of its commutative product into the star product, which is given as such. And I impose three conditions, well, actually four. The star product must be associative. The zeroth order term must be the original commutative product. The antisymmetric piece of the first order term should be the Poisson bracket, which this algebra came with. And finally, equivariance should be imposed, meaning that the grading should be respected. Or alternatively, I give h-bar grading 2 in the conventions I used here. It's clear that our star product is of this type. But in the math literature, they actually go a bit further than just introducing these deformation quantizations, as on the previous slide. They actually group them in these huge equivalence classes. Given some star product, they will construct another star product, which they consider equivalent. And the equivalence goes through defining what they call a gauge transformation. So the gauge transformation takes some algebra element and maps it to itself, plus a tail of higher powers in h-bar, where this tail is still required to be to respect the grading. H-bar is mapped to itself, and then the new star product, which I call star tilde, is constructed by taking this gauge transformed thing, star product, well, the old star product with the gauge transformed thing of the other element, and then invert the gauge transformation. One can figure out that this new star product will have exactly the same properties as the old star product. And that's why mathematicians treat it as an equivalent thing. In our physical problem, we didn't have any such gauge transformations, and it doesn't mean all that much in the physics environment, but we'll see in a second how to deal with it. Given this mathematical machinery, you can in fact classify all the possible C star equivariant deformation quantizations of hyperkähler cones. This is a result by these people, and in physics language, it can be phrased as follows. If I have a theory with a UV Lagrangian description whose Higgs branch I am trying to deform, then the space of inequivalent C-star equivariant deformation quantizations is equal to the space of Fi parameters which deform the Higgs branch into a smooth variety. So remember, the Higgs branch was conical. If I deform the conical singularity by some Fi parameter, I would get something smooth. So we take that space and we mod it out by the Weyl group of the global symmetries that act on the Coulomb branch, in a hyperkähler fashion. So the reason why all of a sudden the Coulomb branch starts showing up is simply because an FI parameter can be introduced by introducing a vector multiplet for the topological Coulomb branch symmetries and giving VEFs to the scalars in that vector multiplet. So these scalars are acted on by these global symmetries, and we should model out by the Weyl group. The conclusion is that the mathematicians have shown that up to these equivalences, there is only a finite space of inequivalent deformation quantizations. In fact, our problem, it had more requirements than just these four. We also had truncation, we had evenness, and we had these unitarity constraints. So let's try to see what those do more than what I have over here. So first of all, the evenness constraint, it demands that the FI parameter should not just be invariant under the Weyl orbit. It should, in fact, lie on the same Weyl orbit as its negative. That's a powerful restriction, which we should impose since our physics problem had this evenness property. And then finally, we had two more properties, the truncation property and the unitarity. And our conjecture is that these, in fact, are perfect gauge fixing conditions. So remember, for each star product, mathematicians can construct another star product using these gauge transformations, which has some same properties. Now the claim is here that these gauge transformations are uniquely fixed by the additional two conditions that we have in the physics context. I will show in examples how this comes about concretely. So indeed, let's go to examples. And let me first just give a general strategy of how we might go about constructing the star products which the physics gave us. So the first strategy I would call the bootstrap philosophy. It just means to write down the most general ansatz which the star products can possibly have, satisfying all the requirements, evenness, truncation, equivariance, but not quite yet unitarity constraints. Unitarity constraints were inequalities on certain coefficients that appeared, and they are hard to impose from the very beginning, since in the next step, we're actually going to solve associativity constraints, and we're going to solve all these structure constants in terms of each other, and it becomes hard to keep track of which one should be positive and which one are still arbitrary. So as I said, the second step is, given these general ansatz, solve associativity constraints. In principle, we should solve associativity constraints for every operator in our theory, every Higgs-Mach-Chiral ring operator. In practice, we're going to organize the triples of operators by increasing total dimension and impose associativity on each of these triples till we run out of computational power. And finally, the last step is to impose the unitarity constraints. Once I have done all these three steps, I will have solved the bootstrap problem, and I have obtained a star product which descends from the three-dimensional SCFT. Of course, I didn't go through this entire introduction to quantization deformation if I were not going to use it. So perhaps a more highbrow approach to solving the star product is the following. Let me try abstractly to identify the quantum algebra. I mean the algebra up to all these equivalences which the mathematicians employ. If I succeed in doing this, then ideally I would like to fix the free parameters which enter in the quantum algebra. So remember, there was this classification theorem. These quantum algebras come with a certain set of free parameters. Ideally, I would like to fix them to the appropriate values of the theory I'm actually looking at. Once I have done these two steps, then the third step should be to solve the gauge fixing conditions such that I not only have a C star equivariant deformation quantization, but actually one that is also even, satisfies my truncation condition, and most importantly, satisfies these unitarity constraints. In examples, we will see that these last two sometimes get mixed up. It's hard to disentangle them, but we'll do the best we can. In fact, the first set of examples doesn't suffer from these problems, as we will see. And the examples I would like to consider are the minimal nilpotent orbits. They are defined by considering adjoint value generators of some group G and subject them to relations given as follows. If I consider the symmetric product of two adjoint representations of this group G, I will find if I decompose that product, I will find a whole zoo of representations. One of them is always the identity. One of them is always the representation which has as its linking labels twice those of the adjoint. And there's a whole zoo of other representations in between. The relations I should impose on these adjoint value things is that all representations that appear in the symmetric product, except for this one, should be set to zero. It's a bit, perhaps, hard to imagine constraint, but it's a very well-defined one. And examples of theories which actually realize these minimally potent orbits are given in these quivers. So these are UV Lagrangian descriptions of 3D SCFTs. And if I want to get minimally potent orbit of type AN, I just look at the U1 theory with N plus 1 hypermultiplets. For the DN type, I would just look at an SU2 theory with N hypermultiplets. Now, let's go back to this definition. It's clear that at dimension 1, there's just one operator which transforms in the adjoint. That's this generator, mu of A. At dimension 2, there's again just one operator which transforms in representation 2 adjoint, because all the other operators that would in principle occur in the symmetric product are set to 0 by the relation. Now, this pattern goes on. At dimension 3, again, there's just one operator which transforms in representation with linking labels 3 times that of adjoint, and so forth. So this means that the quantization deformation problem will not suffer from any gauge ambiguities if I also impose G equivariance, simply because if I take an operator and I start adding in higher order terms in H bar, they will necessarily correspond to operators of lower dimension, and they will sit in different representations. So this is actually a simple example where gauge transformations will not play a role at all. Okay, I've ruled out gauge transformations. Let me now try to count how many parameters the quantizations, deformations of these minimally potent orbits actually depend on. I will use my classification theorem from a couple slides ago. And let's start with this one. I was instructed to look at the space of Fi parameters. This quiver clearly does not have any Fi parameters, so that's it. If I try to quantize the minimally potent orbit of type Dn, there will be no free parameters in the quantum algebra. And there will be no additional parameters due to gauge transformation, so it's completely fixed. For the An case, let's do the case where n is larger than 2 first. There's one Fi parameter corresponding to this U1, but I was instructed by the evenness condition to make sure that that Fi parameter lies on the same vial orbit as its negative, and the vial group I was supposed to look at was that of the global symmetries of the Coulomb branch. The Coulomb branch of this theory is the Kleinian singularity, and it has a U1 global symmetry, but the U1 global symmetry will never be able to have a vial action that takes the Fi parameter to its opposite, since it's a trivial thing. So again, for An theories with n larger than 2, there's no free parameters in my problem. Finally, the case where n is equal to 1, the Coulomb branch, in fact, has an enhanced symmetry. So does a Higgs branch, but never mind that. The Coulomb branch has an enhanced symmetry to SU2. The SU2 does have a vial group. It's a Z2. And that Z2 indeed takes my Fi parameter to its negative. So for A1, I will expect one free parameter. And more generally, for any group that is not of SLN type, there are 0 parameters. SL2 was 1, and SLN larger than or equal to 3, 0. So this is very good. Our deformation quantization problem, or the star product which I got from truncating the conformal bootstrap constraints, is completely and uniquely solved in all cases except for SL2. For SL2, I have one single parameter, but here again, I'm in luck. If I have a UV Lagrangian description of this theory, I can always compute one parameter that is relevant to the problem I'm studying through a localization computation. From localization, I can compute the flavor current two-point function coefficient, which I can then relate to the moment map two-point function coefficient, which indeed enters in the star product I'm talking about. So for all these cases, I know how to fix all parameters if there are any. Good, but I still don't know which algebras I'm actually talking about. But also that problem I can solve. The algebras I'm talking about are actually just generalized higher spin algebras. And more importantly, the structure constants of these algebras, they have been worked out for all the classical groups by Jung and Mkrtchyan. So I'm in good shape. I've solved the entire problem. So let's just look at one particular example, the one of SL2, which was a bit more interesting than the others because there was still one free parameter. So I'm looking at the minimally potent orbit of SL2, which is the same thing as declining singularity C2 over Z2. The quantum algebra, which corresponds to the star product on this space, is the higher spin algebra, HS lambda, which you can also think of as just being the universal enveloping algebra of SL2, modeled out by the relation that the quadratic Casimir should be equal to this particular combination. And the non-commutative product you get by studying this thing was already studied in 1990 by these people and was called the lone star product. And the parameter that enters in the product can be fixed in UV Lagrangian quiver descriptions. So let's do SQED with NF equals 2, which is just this quiver where N is equal to 1. And then I do my localization computation. I compare the value I get to the lambda parameter that enters here, and I find it's actually equal to 0. Maybe you are aware of the fact that the higher spin algebra with parameter lambda equals 0 is a very special thing. It's a free fermion point of the higher spin algebra, and it's also the point where I can extend this algebra to a W infinity algebra without having to introduce negative spins. I don't know if these facts mean anything physically, but it seems that we picked out a very nice value for this interacting superconformal field theory, at least for its star product. Now, another theory that realizes C2 mod Z2 as its Higgs branch is simply the Z2 gauge theory of the free hypermultiplet, which just means I take the free hypermultiplet and look at its Z2 invariant subsector. I know how to compute any star product in that theory because it's just computed by the Moyal star product, which I showed way back in the talk. And you can figure out that then the value has to be lambda equals 2.5. And indeed, it is known in the higher spin literature that HS of a half is precisely given by the Moyal star product. So we basically recovered that little fact through our construction here. So another class of examples, which are perhaps a bit more interesting, since they do suffer from these gauge transformation ambiguities, are the A-type Kleinian singularities. So their definition is simple. We have three generators, X, Y, and Z. Their conformal dimension is of Z is equal to 1, of X and Y is n plus 1 over 2. And they also, this Kleinian singularity comes with the U1 global flavor symmetry that acts on the Higgs branch, and X and Y are charged under that symmetry as follows. So we have three generators, and they satisfy one relation, namely this relation. Theories which realize these Kleinian singularities as their Higgs branches are, for example, the circular quiver gauge theories, where each node is a U1, and the number of nodes is n plus 1. Another case is, as we had on the previous slide, just the Zn plus 1 gauge theory of the free hyper. The holomorphic Poisson bracket, I wrote it here. It's not all that important, but you can figure it out. It's just some piece of information that comes from the hyperkähler structure. And then let's go through the approach I outlined, the strategy, using deformation quantizations. And as an example, I will take A2. So let's first identify the quantum algebra. It is generated by three non-commutative variables, x hat, y hat, z hat, which are subjected to commutation relations depending on one parameter, this kappa over here. So you see, if I put this kappa to 0, then these commutation relations are essentially these Poisson brackets, but I have deformed them over here. And note that I only have one parameter appearing because I already imposed the constraints of evenness. If I wouldn't have done that, there would also be a term over here, zeta squared z hat, which comes with an arbitrary coefficient. But that one was already ruled out by evenness. So these are the commutation relations of these three non-commutative variables. And they are also this algebra is also to be modeled out by the two-sided ideal generated by omega hat, which is written over here. So it's just the definition of the quantum algebra. It depends on one parameter, kappa. And the next problem I should solve is, in principle, what is the value of kappa for interesting theories? But let me postpone that and move immediately to trying to solve the gauge fixing conditions. So let me do first the truncation conditions. If I impose the truncation condition to be valid, so I take the star product as defined by this algebra, and I consider gauge transformations till I reach a point where, in fact, the star product also satisfies the truncation property, I can figure out that these gauge transformations can depend on a single parameter. So out of these infinite possible gauge transformations, I'm left with a one-dimensional gauge slice which still satisfies the truncation. The simplest position where this parameter actually enters is in the gauge transformation of the operator z squared, as written over here. So here are some explicit star products you get after performing this gauge transformation and given this definition of the algebra. And the final step is now to impose these unitarity constraints. As I said, they demand that these coefficients, the constant coefficients in this star product, like this minus alpha here, or this 3 alpha plus k over 2 over here, they should have definite sign. And if I start imposing that these kind of expressions have these signs, I end up with the following plots. Here I have imposed the unitarity constraints up to operators of dimension 2, of dimension 3, of dimension 4, of dimension 5. And it's clear what happens. The allowed values in the kappa alpha plane are dramatically reduced till at the end of the day, in fact over here, we end up with what looks essentially like a line. So we have collapsed the gauge transformation parameter to be completely determined in terms of the quantum algebra parameter. This is what I promised you. I promised you that gauge transformations will uniquely fix, the gauge fixing conditions will be perfect. They will completely fix the gauge transformation freedom that I have in principle in defining these star products from a mathematical point of view. So in this plot, I have indicated two special features, namely this dot. It's a Z3 gauge theory of the free hyper. We know everything about it, since again, it can be computed through the Moyal star product, and it lies exactly on the line as it should. Another theory I can consider is the one where I have three U1 nodes connected in a triangle. That theory also has a Higgs branch given by the A2 Kleinian singularity. And in that theory, I can use localization computations to compute, again, one coefficient. In fact, the coefficient I can compute is a two-point function of z, so it's this parameter alpha over here. I did compute it, and what I found was that it lies somewhere on this line. So this line is the parameter value of alpha for the gauge theory I just described. So let's zoom in a bit around here and around here. So now you see that the line on the previous slide, in fact, still has a very narrow finite width, which is related to the fact that I have not imposed all gauge fixing conditions yet, but just the ones I found up to dimension 6. But you see the dot lies nicely inside this very narrow region. And over here, you see that the parameter kappa must lie in this very narrow region. And in fact, it looks like it wants to take value minus a quarter. It's not the first time we see special values appear for the parameters in the quantum algebra. Remember, lambda was equal to 0 a couple of slides ago. Now it seems like kappa wants to be minus a quarter. I don't know how I would go about proving that kappa has this value, but it's an interesting open problem, given that it seems to take a nice value, to actually compute this value in some other way. So this was the A2 Kleinian singularity. We have similar results for the A3 Kleinian singularity. In this case, the quantum algebra depends on two parameters. There's this kappa and lambda. And the gauge slice, which I'm left with after imposing the truncation condition, is again one-dimensional. And you see, again, by imposing more and more unitarity constraints, the allowed region in this parameter space gets basically squashed to a surface. So for each choice of kappa and lambda, there's a unique value of alpha. Again, the gauge fixing conditions are perfect. And in this plot, I indicated the value of alpha, which corresponds to the gauge theory, which has four U1 nodes organized in a square. And it singles out a line in the kappa lambda plane, but I do not know how to actually fix the values of kappa and lambda that correspond to the theory. with four nodes in a square. So let me conclude with some future directions. As I mentioned before, it seems like there are some interesting values to be computed. And it may be interesting to check if they may be computable through localization, or perhaps even if the entire structure I have uncovered is accessible through localization. Another interesting line of thought is to relate these results to the quantization deformations that appear when studying the omega deformation. The first problem you would face when trying to relate these things is, of course, that when implementing the omega deformation, you have actually deformed the theory, while we remain purely at a superconformal fixed point. So one should establish a dictionary between the omega deformed information and the information at a fixed point. And then maybe one can figure out if there's any relation between the two appearances of quantum deformation. Another line of research that one could consider is inserting conformal defects. One can insert a line operator along the line I singled out, or one can insert boundary conditions or domain walls in a plane orthogonal to the line. And in all these cases, one can study what the effect would be on the star product. And finally, from a more mathematical point of view, it would be very interesting if one could actually prove that the gauge fixing conditions, which I claim are perfect, are indeed perfect. So that was it. Thank you. Right, you can do it. So ABGM theories typically have a bit more supersymmetry, but you can consider them as N equals 4 superconformal field theories and do exactly the same I have taught you here. So in fact, one of the ABJR theories, the one with U1 times SU2, I forget the levels of the transformance levels, it also gives rise to this C2 mod Z2, and the parameter lambda is actually also equal to 0. So it also takes this special parameter value. But more generally, you could consider them all and apply this machinery to it.
Interested in the this fast future direction. I think that the localization computation is the only accessible expectation, but it's just BPS quantity.
Right, but everything we have considered here is BPS.
Okay, but in that computation, the operator should preserve the supersymmetry that is used in the localization.
Yes, you should use a different supercharge to localize, to end up with this kind of...
I see.
So you wouldn't use the one that is typically used, you would use a weaker one in some sense. I mean, one that doesn't square to the two U1 rotations, but probably just to one U1 rotation.
I mean, in many of these algebras, things like Young-Yens and particularly Young-Yens, that are along with certain mathematics, some other points of view. So, do you have any feeling to how this extra structure relates to the theory of quantum groups?
Yeah. Probably not. Not on the top of my head, no.
Are there any other questions?
No, that's not all.